Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, and I do have a guest slated to join me today, but we're having a bit of a delay getting him on the line. So until that point, I'd like to discuss some happenings in this world of ours, particularly with regard to Ukraine. What's happening now with Zelensky, the puppet president of Ukraine? Well, apparently the U.S. zombie president, Joe Biden, is throwing Zelensky under the bus. This according to a Zero Hedge piece that was published this past Sunday titled "Biden Throws Zelensky Under the Bus, Ukraine Leader, quote, brushed off, unquote, invasion warnings." It's a quite interesting piece that begs a lot of questions as to the veracity of the statements that are now being made by both Zelensky and Biden. So I'm going to go through it here and lay out the utter shit show that the diplomacy between Ukraine and the US, if you can call it diplomacy, has become. President Joe Biden on Friday, meaning this past Friday, the 10th, told a donors conference in Los Angeles, California, on the sidelines of the Summit of the Americas, which, by the way, excluded a number of Latin American countries, including Venezuela, from which the U.S. is now begging for oil. Quite some irony there. So on the sidelines of the Summit of the Americas, Biden told a donors conference that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky brushed aside U.S. warnings, saying a Russian invasion of Ukraine was imminent. This, of course, being earlier in the year in January and February. Going on here, Biden described the situation ahead of the February 24th invasion and his communications with Zelensky, according to the Associated Press. Quote, "Nothing like this has happened since World War II. I know a lot of people thought I was maybe exaggerating, unquote, Biden said, according to the outlet. He added the U.S. had data that showed Russian President Vladimir Putin was going to invade. Quote, "There was no doubt," unquote, Biden continued. Quote, "And Zelensky didn't want to hear it," unquote. So this right here brings up the question of, is this true, or is Biden simply saying this now because everybody with a pair of eyes can read the writing on the wall that Ukraine is losing, has indeed lost this war. The Kiev regime has its back against the wall. I don't know. Is Biden trying to evade some sort of culpability here? I don't know, but it's a valid question, and one can form his or her own opinion. But going on, in his latest remarks, Biden admitted that the possibility of Putin launching a full-scale invasion may have seemed far-fetched at the time, acknowledging, quote, "I understand why they didn't want to hear it," unquote, they being Ukraine. Again, this begging the question of veracity, of whether or not Biden and his administration are trying to evade culpability. And I've just been informed that my guest has connected, so I'm going to bring him on, and we're going to discuss what I've started getting into here a bit further, along with various other developments related to the war in Ukraine and Russia. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Alex Craner. Alex, of course, is a friend of the show. He is a former hedge fund manager. He's worked as a market analyst and has traded in financial and commodity derivatives for over 20 years. He is the creator of the iSystem and founder of iSystem Trend Following. In addition to all of that, he is the founder of Craner Analytics and the author of three books: Alex Craner's Trend Following Bible, Mastering Uncertainty, and Grand Deception. Alex, welcome back to Perspective. How are you?
Hi, Jesse. Thank you very much. Sorry about the delay. I had a small technical problem, but better late than never.
No worries. Glad you're here. So I want to start off with the situation in the east of Ukraine, if you still want to consider Donbass part of Ukraine. This is where the war is very much focused now, where massive violence is taking place, particularly violence that's being meted out by the armed forces of Ukraine against civilian populations in Donbass. We've seen indiscriminate shelling of Donetsk, not just over the past few days, but over the past few weeks, and even going back to March 14th, when there was the initial Tochka U strike on downtown Donetsk, which killed around 24 people, injured many people. One of those injured was a child. It seems like the armed forces of Ukraine know their time is up. They're retreating and they're pursuing a scorched earth policy in their retreat, which translates, as I said, to this indiscriminate shelling, which is killing women and children. We saw these reports yesterday. What's your assessment of what's going on here?
I'm a little bit at a loss of how to explain this. It seems to me that this is indiscriminate. It's not even indiscriminate shelling. I think they're deliberately shelling civilian areas of Donetsk. And it seems to me like it's nothing more than an act of vengeance, because they are losing the war. They have pretty much lost the war. And now all they have left is to inflict as much harm as they can on the civilian population of Donetsk. I don't know what the sense of it is, because to the best of my knowledge, the Russians not only can accurately pinpoint the sources of these strikes, but they usually tend to know which units are firing off these shells, and they usually know fully well who the commanders of those units are. Mm-hmm. So I have to guess that maybe the Western sponsors of the Ukrainian armed forces, which are the United States and the NATO, have ordered them to do this in order to try to still provoke some kind of a, let's say, ugly act of reprisal from the Russians, so that they can, you know, maybe justify some kind of a false flag attack and prolong the war, or expand it, or still produce some kind of a, you know, galvanizing effect in the West, which has, I think, completely lost any appetite for a confrontation with Russia. Mm-hmm. And in this way, in this way, to continue trying to achieve their original purpose, which was to weaken Russia, to break its resolve, to ultimately destabilize it, to bring about regime change, so that, you know, maybe Russian people get so revolted that they overthrow Vladimir Putin's government, and, you know, then the West gets its chance for a regime change. I cannot think up a better rationale for all this, but obviously I don't think that it's going to make any difference. The Russians have their objective set from start. They've been very methodical and effective in achieving them, and I think that that's what they're going to be doing. And then, you know, when the dust settles, they're going to be demanding justice, and whatever is left of the rump Ukraine is going to have to sit at a table with the Russians and conclude some kind of a peace. And mm-hmm. at that point, the Russians are going to demand accountability for strikes on civilian populations. And my guess is that they're going to get it. And all these people that are shelling the civilian areas in Donetsk and might think that they're going to get away with it, might not be able to get away with it in the end.
Right. I agree with you that this isn't just indiscriminate shelling. This is intentional shelling, because I've watched many reports now on RT in particular from the scenes of areas that have been shelled, and there are no military targets anywhere near those scenes. And surely these units who are shelling know that, and therefore that points to intentionality. But you bring up a point which I want to ask you about. Given that this shelling continues, to your knowledge, is Russia hitting any of these units which are doing the shelling? Because I've seen people online asking that question, where is the Russian defense to take out the sites where these shells are being fired from?
Look, I have to presume so, but I have no information to that effect at all. They have these radars that can pinpoint the source of shelling, and I'm certain that they have countermeasures, that they immediately seek to neutralize those sources, but I don't have any information that they're doing so in fact.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. What's also interesting, too, is that there seems to be, and I have this from the reporting of my TNT colleague, George Eliason, who's actually based in Lugansk. He said that there may be another Azovstal situation at a plant that is near Severodonetsk City. This is the Azot plant, A-Z-O-T. And apparently there are humanitarian corridors that have been arranged by Russia to evacuate civilians from Severodonetsk, but it appears there are forces. I don't know if these are Azov or Pravi sector or related entities who are holed up in this plant in Severodonetsk, which is, of course, a focal point in Lugansk right now in this war. Do you have any knowledge of what's going on there, or can you speak to what's going on there in any capacity?
Not with any concrete information, Jesse, but it seems to me, from the pattern of previous events, that let's say that the regular units of Ukrainian army first are not as well equipped. Or trained, or commanded, as the far right units, and so I think that they are more inclined to try to surrender and give up and stay alive. And they might also have lesser culpability for the crimes of war that have been perpetrated over the last 8 years, because, you know, the Donbas, the civilian Donbas areas have been shelled almost on a daily basis for over 8 years now. And, mm-hmm. you know, people who are responsible for that probably understand that they should not surrender, because what awaits them is possibly death penalty mm-hmm. if they're brought to justice. Because, you know, for the large part, the Russian side, they know exactly who these people are by name. And so, maybe rather than surrendering, they're going to try to go all the way, dig in and resist, hoping that somehow, the West will conjure up some kind of a cavalry and rescue them. Similar scenario as with the Azovstal complex in Mariupol. I think it's very, very highly dubious that's a good bet on their part.
Yeah, I agree. They are certainly desperate now. As I said in my introduction, anybody with two eyes can read the writing on the wall. Since you brought up justice, we've seen in the past week the trials of three mercenaries, two from Britain, one from Morocco. The Britons, Pinner, who of course now are trying to act completely remorseful with regard to what they've been involved with, saying they didn't know what they were getting involved with.
George Eliason on TNT Radio.
And we're going to talk a lot about Ukraine today. What's going on? And get into some issues that people aren't touching on enough. Now, there was a lot of talk over the course of a couple months about Russia using chemical weapons in Ukraine. And the Biden administration kept insisting it was going to happen. Zelensky's administration kept insisting it was going to happen. And across Europe, every PM, everybody echoed this. Everybody was so sure Russia was going to use chemical weapons in Ukraine. Well, Russia was certified as not having chemical weapons about 10 years ago. They just don't have them. That presents kind of a problem in that scenario, but what were they actually trying to do? On May 30th or 31st of this year, a chemical weapons incident happened.
George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, I'm Charlize Theron with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Almost all the puppies for sale at your local mall were churned out by breeding facilities called puppy mills.
Constant confinement drives the dogs mad. They are impregnated continually until they can no longer produce a litter.
If you choose a dog from the mall, a dog you could have saved from the pound will die.
Contact PETA to learn how you can make a difference at 757-622-PETA or visit PETA.org.
Hey Australia, there's never been a better time to check up on your health. We have a world-class healthcare system that's easy to access, even when you can't be there in person. Telehealth enables you to catch up with your GP or health professional, and the Australian government has now made it permanently available through Medicare. Show your health some love, face-to-face, by phone or video call. Care for your health. Find out more at australia.gov.au. Authorised by the Australian Government, Canberra.
Get breaking news on your phone when it happens. Download our app from the Google Play and App Store now.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell. I apologize for cutting out there. Not sure what happened on my end. Perhaps the SBU is listening in. I'm speaking with Alex Craner. And just before I cut out, I was making the point that justice is already being dispensed by the people of Donbass. We've seen the trials and convictions and sentencings of three mercenaries, two from the UK, one from Morocco, and there are probably a lot more of these trials to come. Whether these individuals are going to be condemned by the firing squad absolutely remains to be seen. They have the ability to appeal. They could get caught up in some sort of prisoner exchange. It remains to be seen. But when this is compared with the trial of the Russian soldier that recently occurred, which by all the looks of it, looks like some sort of drum trial, at least what's going on in the DPR, has the makings of an actual trial. I'm not there on the ground. I can't say for sure, but these individuals were provided a lawyer. There was a trial. They have the right to appeal. It seems like a genuine justice system is trying to hold these individuals to account. So, Alex, I want to move on from there and get into what I was speaking about before you connected. This past Friday at the Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles, Biden stated, quote, "Nothing like this has happened since World War II." Here he's referring to Russia entering Ukraine and the war that is currently happening now. He went on to say, "I know a lot of people thought I was maybe exaggerating." And then went on to add that the U.S. had data that showed Russian President Vladimir Putin was going to invade. And Biden continued saying, quote, "There was no doubt and Zelensky didn't want to hear it," unquote. So it seems like a lot of excuses and prevarications are being put out now that the writing is on the wall. But I want to get your take on all of this. What's your sense of this clamoring of excuses and maybe even lies that we're hearing from both Biden and Zelensky at this point?
Well, you know, to me, the extent to which Joe Biden is comfortable with just flat out lying to the public is absolutely shocking, you know, because that nothing like this has ever happened since World War II. I mean, did he forget about Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria and Somalia and so forth? I mean, this has happened a lot. The only difference is that this time it's Russia that's invaded another country and not the United States or NATO. And so that's number one. Number two, I think that the failure of their gambit, and their gambit was basically to use Ukraine as a proxy to try to destabilize, weaken, regime change Russia through this war. They wanted to drag Russia into a quagmire. They kept talking about, oh, this could be a new Afghanistan for Russia, you know, like in the 1980s when Russia got dragged into the war in Afghanistan. They invaded Afghanistan, and then, you know, by the time that fiasco unraveled, you had the whole Soviet Union start to unravel and it ultimately collapsed, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that they were hoping for that kind of an outcome, but it obviously failed, and it failed spectacularly. The West had already a prepared set of sanctions, which were the most drastic, most draconian sanctions ever imposed on another country in history. And they were hoping that this would collapse Russian economy, further destabilizing the country, further turning Russian people against Vladimir Putin. But none of that happened. And in fact, the whole thing had the opposite outcome. Not only is Russia winning and achieving its objectives in Ukraine, Russia's economy took relatively a minor setback from all these sanctions and has come back roaring. You know, most of the world refused to go along with the sanctions, and the Russian ruble, which was intended to be collapsed, is actually today by far the best performing foreign currency in the world. Mm-hmm. And you know, the market, when the markets are telling you something, that something is probably true, and the markets are telling you today that Russia is winning militarily, strategically, and economically. And so now all that they have left to do is to deflect culpability and to try to pin the blame for the fiasco on somebody else. And I think that the easiest side to pin the blame on is obviously the Zelensky regime and Zelensky himself, who is, you know, nothing but a puppet, not just of the Western powers, but also of the far right side of Ukraine's policies. You know, he was elected with a landslide on the basis of his promises to make peace with Russia, to to bring the military confrontation in the Donbas to an end, and to focus on development of Ukraine. And then very, very soon into his tenure, he was told, if you try to make peace with Russians, you'll be hanging off of a lamppost. You'll be killed. And so
Dmytro Yarosh told him that, or said that in an interview.
Right. And so, you know, these pressures were brought to bear on Zelensky. And I think he was way out of his depth. He didn't know what he was getting into. And he had to kind of go along with this to, you know, for his own physical preservation. Mm-hmm. And so he's the, you know, he's the easy side to blame in all this, because he was the one who exposed himself most in the West, in the Western media. And so there you have it. So Biden's statements, which are always, always cavalier with the truth, always cavalier in the way they interpret the events, are now ready to throw Zelensky under the bus. If they get rid of Zelensky, I don't frankly know what comes next, because, you know, any kind of pro-Russian faction in Ukraine, meaning, you know, when I say pro-Russian, I mean somebody who will be willing and able to sit down at the table with the Russians and sign some kind of a peace treaty that is acceptable to the Russians, and their demands mm-hmm. are not slight, you know, probably cannot take over in Ukraine. And if you put in any far-right parts of the Ukrainian political leadership, you're not going to get any difference in the way in Ukrainian politics. It's still going to be confrontational with Russia. They're still going to remain rigidly opposed to making peace with Russia. And I think that the result will be just a continuation of war in some other way. And what that other way will be, I'm not sure, but I have a feeling that it could morph into a civil war within the rump Ukraine, the remainder mm-hmm. of Ukraine. And then, you know, the wild card is, are the Poles going to get involved? Because Poles have, you know, Poland has pretensions on very large parts of Ukrainian territories, and on the city of Lvov, which, you know, yes, historically used to be part of Poland.
I wanted to ask you about that.
I think it's very unpredictable, because at this point, you know, nobody can openly tell you this is what we intend to do, but we can see that they are kind of how do you call it? They're being ambivalent. There's no statements that no, we will not get involved. No, we'll, you know, stay on our sides of the border. And I think, frankly, that the Western powers are, let's say, encouraging the Poles to think in that direction, that they could get mm-hmm. involved, that they could send in the troops, quote unquote, peacekeepers into the west of Ukraine. And I think that the Polish ultimate objective is to annex that part of the Ukrainian territory, at least on the right side of the Polish political life.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that annexation or potential annexation has very deep historical roots, which go back to, you could say, the beginning of the 20th century, but you can go farther back than that.
Yeah, and, I think you can go farther back than that. Yes, correct.
Right. And I was listening to, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but Martin Armstrong speak in an interview last night.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how these centuries old enmities or rivalries, if we can term them that way, are remembered throughout Europe in each individual European state. It's something that's quite a bit different here in the US, there isn't that sort of collective memory within states about the history. So he gave an example of how he was recently in Austria, I believe it was, and they were celebrating the victory of a war against Prussia, which he may or may not have been familiar with. But his point was that these enmities are remembered, and they are still very much at the surface to this day and still play a large part in what's happening in Ukraine beyond the NATO aggression, beyond what Russia is trying to do with demilitarizing and denazifying and essentially neutralizing Ukraine. On the periphery, you could say, or underlying all of this, there are these historical remembrances that play a very important part in what's happening. So going from there, I would like to ask you about something that your colleague, Tom Longo, recently published on his blog. It's been republished by Zero Hedge, and it's a piece entitled Lagarde Capitulates as the Eurozone Divides. And what he lays out in here is the Eurozone heading into a massive crisis. And despite that being obvious and something that he's been talking about for quite some time, we have Christine Lagarde recently getting up and saying something to the effect of the EU has inflation, the ECB has inflation under control, there will still be growth in 2022, and this growth will accelerate in 2023 and 2024. And she's, of course, referring primarily to GDP growth. And this is laughable given all of what we've seen, develop over the past several months. You don't have to be an economist to find this laughable. But given that you are very steeped in economics, you have a degree in economics, I'd like to get your take on these statements by Lagarde. Is this just lying in service of damage control, or does the ECB and other central banks in Western Empire, for that matter, do they have some sort of control that they may not be making evident in statements like these?
No, absolutely not. They do not have control of inflation, because if they did, inflation wouldn't be at the levels that we're seeing it now. And, you know, I would like to remind your listeners that, you know, with inflation, let's use a metaphor, you know, like when the plane goes down, it's not the falling of the plane that kills everybody on board. It's the sudden stopping at the end, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, just because we haven't come to the point of impact with inflation yet doesn't mean that everything is under control. It just means that things haven't completely fallen apart yet. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place, because if they stop quantitative easing, printing of money, the situation is going to go dramatically bad. You're going to see a lot of bankruptcies. You might see bank failures, and you might see like a deflationary depression emerge. If, on the other hand, they revert to quantitative easing, which I predict that they ultimately will have to, then you're going to get hyperinflation at some point. You know, you're going to get an inflation that accelerates to the point where it turns into a hyperinflation. Now, I did want to go back just a minute to those ancient enmities that you were mentioning. I know I'm skipping back to the previous subject, but there's something that I wanted to point out that may not be obvious. But, you know, yes, all these enmities exist, you know, like there are these arguments within a nation's body politic that, you know, we belong here, this territory should be ours, this division of borders was not just, and blah, 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 blah. But that doesn't have to be a problem until somebody decides to start making it a problem. You know, absolutely. And then you're going to have these, you're going to get these think tanks producing these papers, and then you have a contrived hysteria that's going to be amplified by the media. You know, this is all done deliberately and on purpose. And I think that the American people will recognize it, because what you now have being thrown in your face is almost nonstop is this white supremacy, you know, like you would think that you're back in the 1950s and 1960s, and that racism and white supremacy is just like the biggest problem that the country is facing. Whereas instead, mm-hmm. you know, somebody decided to start creating divisions and agitate and polarize the population in the country. I guess part of the reason is to distract them from other problems, but a part of the reason is because, you know, when you create these emergencies, then the government can take upon itself to enact emergency measures. When emotions are running hot, then, you know, you're going to have a segment of the population that's going to go along with censorship, with doing away with, you know, Second Amendment, with doing away with, you know, they're going to be okay with packing the Supreme Court, and so on and so forth. And this is also something that they can do in different other countries. I have experienced this before the war broke out in the former Yugoslavia. You know, all of a sudden, at some point in 1990 and late 1989, the media started producing all these stories about nationalism, about how the Croats are a threat to the Serbs are a threat to the Croats. And this mm-hmm. just started appearing in the newspapers on a daily basis. Whereas the people, this wasn't reflected of how the people actually felt. You know, I'm a child of a mixed marriage. My mother is Serbian, my father is Croatian. They live perfectly mm-hmm. well together. They are together to this day. Many of us, you know, growing up, we had no idea which one of our friends was a Serb or a Muslim or a Croat. It's just, you know, like you just got along with people. You went to your football practice, to your water polo practice. You went to school, you played, you did what normal people do. And this is what normal people will do on normal occasions. But somebody decides like, okay, we want to redo these things. We have our power agendas. And for that, we might need to polarize the situation in the society. So they start doing these things, you know, like, and I think that the best metaphor, I may have mentioned it on one of our last interviews, but the best metaphor is something that I found from David Attenborough, you know, the British documentary filmmaker. He made these wonderful wildlife documentaries during mm-hmm. his career. And here's the interesting thing he said. He said, like, if you take 100 red ants and 100 black ants and you put them into a large jar and you observe them, nothing happens. You know, they just go about their business trying to get out of the jar, I guess. But if you violently shake up the jar, then they will start fighting between themselves. Then they go to war, the reds against the blacks, mm-hmm. you know? And so this is what actually happens, you know? And so people just, you know, like people should not think about who's the white supremacist and who are the victims. They should think about who is shaking up the jar and why. And somebody's always shaking up the jar, and there's always a reason why. And I think that if you pay attention and you analyze the situation, you can also guess why they're shaking up the jar.
Right. Yes, I'm glad you clarified that, and I should have added that to what I was saying, because I certainly wasn't implying that these age-old enmities are something that citizens of these countries are constantly thinking about and constantly trying to provoke. That's not the case. Maybe there are some citizens who exactly. think that way, but by and large, that is not the case. And as you pointed out with your parents, people live in harmony despite their different ethnic backgrounds and historical rivalries. And we saw the US and neocons pursue this exact strategy in Iraq, turning Shia against Sunni. And under Saddam Hussein, of all people, there was the highest intermarriage rate between Shia and Sunni in the entire Arab world. And that was destroyed by the US enterprise, by the neocon enterprise. And it was destroyed intentionally. And we can see what it did. It turned the US war on Iraq into a civil war between Shia and Sunni that was extremely bloody and is still essentially happening to this day in different iterations, but it continues. That ancient enmity, I keep coming back to that word, but that's really what it is, was seized upon and brought to the surface, and these people who had otherwise lived in harmony were pitted against each other so that those who were doing the pitting could get what they wanted while through divide and conquer. And I think that's what we saw as well in 2014 with the Maidan putsch. I think these people knew of the history of Ukraine, its history with Nazism, and they took advantage of this and did a lot to propel people like Tiahnai Buk and what's his name? I always forget his name. Beletsky, these sorts of people, Yarosh. It did a lot to try to propel them to the fore, and some of them took it and went with it. People like Tiahnai Buk and Beletsky, but there were others like Yarosh, who didn't want anything to do with the government. He saw a more powerful place for him outside of the traditional government structure, and that seems to have worked out quite well for him, especially with regard to his control over the SBU and what it's been able to do successfully for it within Ukraine. I'm not saying that what it's done is a success by any measure. It's been murderous. But yeah, I'm glad you make that point. It's very important to understand that. So just to wrap up here, I want to ask you a few questions about how Russia has fared economically. As you pointed out earlier, it's doing quite well despite the sanctions. And there are questions out there about how much preparation Russia did in advance, knowing that these sanctions were probably coming. And one of the questions I have is, when I look at the Bank for International Settlements, there's a report that says essentially that Russia and its central bank have been excommunicated from anything to do with the BIS, but Russia is still obviously making international transactions with countries who say they're on board with sanctions, but they're flouting the sanctions. They're still buying, or the so-called sanctions, and still buying Russian energy. And so these transactions have to be settled through the BIS, to the best of my knowledge. So what's going on with all of that? How do you explain that?
Well, first of all, Russia is economically in a good place fundamentally. You know, the sanctions have caused some harm. They have caused some disruption in the Russian, you know, in the ordinary functioning of the Russian economy. You know, certain trades have been blocked, certain imports have fallen away. The border crossings have become much more difficult. You know, but Russia is very, very well provisioned with food and energy, which are essential, which you cannot print out from the central bank printing press. You know, you cannot conjure it up out of thin air. And mm-hmm. So I think that Russians have thought this through very, very thoroughly, and they have prepared for a very, very long time for this. Not mm-hmm. just the 8 years since the Maidan coup, but in the last 30 years, because, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, the Western advisors basically made the bad situation much, much worse, and the Russians found themselves dependent on the West for essential foodstuffs, you know, like wheat and soybeans and corn. And the Western, you know, the IMF and the World Bank did not hesitate to blackmail Russian leadership with this food dependence, you know, and they said, like, well, if you default on your debt, all the ships that are bringing wheat to the Black Sea ports are just going to turn around straight away. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, the Yeltsin government just had to do whatever they asked him to do, because he could not tolerate, you know, he could not withstand the Russians starving. You know, they would, then he would be hanging off of a lamppost. Mm. This time around, the situation is much, much different. With regards to the membership, to Russia's membership in the BIS, it's true that a lot of trade, a lot of the trade balances were settled through the Bank of International Settlement. But this is just one mechanism, and you could easily create other mechanisms. And Russians are already busy talking to the countries of the South America and the Africans and the South, you know, the global South. And they are proposing alternative methods of settling trade balances, you know. So, you know, if Russia exports, if Russia imports cocoa and coffee from African countries, and African countries can pay them in dollars, then, you know, Russians the Russians can't pay them in dollars to their BIS balances. Then they can create bilateral mechanisms. Russians can build nuclear power plants for them. They can sell them weapons. They can sell them oil and gas or potash or fertilizers, whatever, you know. So these, mm-hmm. you know, before the Soviet Union collapsed, we had a separate clearing mechanism with the Eastern European countries and the Soviet Union. Like, I'm talking about the former Yugoslavia, where I grew up. Mm-hmm. So we always made a difference between the hard dollars and the clearing dollars. You know, they would call this the clearing dollars, because it was accounted for in terms in equivalence of US dollars, but the exchange didn't occur in actual dollar balances. Okay, so mm-hmm. these mechanisms can fairly easily be recreated on a bilateral basis between Russia and any country together. And I think that in the future, they will gradually create a completely different clearing mechanisms for countries that, you know, will opt out of the Bank of International Settlements and the Western financial mechanisms.
Yes. Okay. That makes sense. Because as I said, to my knowledge, the Bank of International Settlements is the central bank of all central banks and handles these international transactions. But we have to look at structures that are being set up outside of that. And it's good that there are structures being set up outside of that, because the BIS is a repugnant institution as far as I'm concerned. So I appreciate you clarifying that and explaining that. That makes things make a lot more sense to my mind. So Alex Kreiner, thank you very much for your time today. I'm glad that we were able to have this conversation despite the technical glitches, but I blame the SBU for that. And I look forward to talking to you. I look forward to talking to you again soon, sir. Please be well.
Jesse, thank you for having me, and all the best. Look forward to speaking again. Thank you.
Great. That's it for me. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Stay tuned, though, for the Misty Winston Show up next.